Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is October 29th, 2012, and my guest is Joshua Rao, Professor of Finance at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business and a Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Josh, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thanks very much, Russ. Pleasure to be here.
Before we get started, I want to mention that I'm recording this in the suburbs of Maryland on October 29th, which is the day that Sandy, the storm, is supposed to arrive. So unusually out of character for these podcasts, my family is all home. School is canceled. If you hear any noises in the background, small children fighting, large children fighting, et cetera, just ignore them. It's just my family. Our topic...
A little foggy on the West Coast this morning, but otherwise not so bad.
Yeah, well, this is a little bit of tit for tat, you know. The West Coast has lots of catastrophic environmental effects every once in a while, and nature rears its head. So this is our turn to get worked up and sell out on batteries, flashlights, milk, et cetera. Our topic for today is the work you've done on the fiscal challenges at the state level of public pensions. That is, pensions that have been promised to current and future state employees. Why is there a problem? What's the nature of it? What's there to worry about?
Well, it's interesting because most citizens in the U.S. who have been following economics or politics are very aware that the federal government in Washington is facing severe financial imbalances, which means that the tax revenues that the federal government is taking in are substantially less than the amounts that they're paying for government programs and services. And furthermore, it's been widely publicized that the promises that the federal government has made about Social Security and Medicare far exceed the projected revenues that will be used to fund those programs. We also regularly hear news from Europe about the debt crises being experienced there in Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain, possibly Italy. But what many outside economic policy circles don't realize is that state and local governments around the U.S. are also facing very severe financial imbalances. And I say outside economic policy circles because this is a point that most academic policy experts seem to agree on. The University of Chicago has run an online experts forum for a while where they survey economics professors who are public policy experts. And this is a panel that is quite diverse with respect to university, geography, and political tendencies. As of the end of last month, they were actually asked whether they agreed with the statement that during the next two decades, some U.S. states, unless they substantially increase taxes, cut spending, or change public sector pensions, will require a combination of severe austerity budgets, a federal bailout, and or default. And 92% of the IGM experts either agreed or strongly agreed with that statement. 5% were uncertain. 3% had no opinion.
Great.
And I think to get your question of, you asked about pensions, which is what I work on. A lot of people will look at that result, that polling result, and say, how could this be? I mean, I thought that under the balanced budget requirements of most states, that state and local governments have to run quasi-balanced budgets.
In fact, so how could they default?
Well, in fact, every state except Vermont must balance its budget according to some definition, with the earliest of these provisions going all the way back to the 19th century, when the federal government had established sort of a precedent for bailing states out of their war debts after the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, but after the financial panic of 1837, they declined to step in and absorb state debts. A bunch of states defaulted at that point, 8 states, including Pennsylvania and Maryland, also the territory of Florida, not yet a state, defaulted on their on their debts, and subsequently many states implemented balanced budget requirements. So that gets the puzzle. How can we have reached the point that, according to 92% of academic economic policy experts, U.S. states are going to require austerity budgets, federal bailouts, or default if they've set these rules in the past that limit the extent to which they can borrow money? You know, how can it be that many of them seem to be facing the likelihood of what essentially sounds like a sovereign debt crisis, not unlike what European nations have been experiencing? And the answer to how this is going to happen is really what my research is about, which is that it must lie in promises for future spending that have not been and still are not recognized in today's budgetary processes. So in other words, these balanced budget requirements, they may require states to spend as much in, you know, kind of current spending as they take in tax revenues and other revenues, but they don't prohibit states from making promises in the future to make payments in the future to people that they can't keep. And in the instance of the states, those promises, the largest of those promises, are actually promises that the state will take care of the retirements of state and local public employees.
Yeah, so the technical term for this is unfunded liabilities, which is just a fancy phrase to mean you've got promises down the road and you haven't set the money aside yet in the current period to fund those promises.
That's exactly right. And the balanced budget requirements tend to focus a lot on what's going on in sort of the near-term budgetary planning. But if a state is promising that they're going to pay for the pension benefits of public sector employees when those employees retire, then it becomes critical to ask whether the state or local governments are doing sufficient planning to be able to pay those benefits. And the reason it's critical in terms of understanding whether the state really truly is running a balanced budget is that, you know, imagine for a second that we kind of told all police and teachers and firemen that we were going to pay them annual pensions when they retire, from the time that they retire at age 50, 55, 60, 65, you know, that varies based on the state, until the time that they die. Imagine we do that, but imagine that we didn't set aside any money at all for that we just did no planning for that. Well, that would clearly not be in the spirit of running a balanced budget, and that would clearly also not be in the spirit of what economists like to call intergenerational fairness, because the next generation of taxpayers, our kids, or maybe us in 10, 15 years when the employees of today are retiring, that next generation will have to pay both for the services from public safety officials and teachers and other public servants that they are consuming at that future time, and for the pensions of the retired public servants who served us in our time. So for that reason, you know, the sense in which we're running a balanced budget, it's very critical to understand to what extent we're running a balanced budget, and that's going to require understanding whether we are planning sufficiently well for the promises that we are making to take care of the retirements of public sector employees.
But of course, you could just say, well, okay, so we haven't planned enough, but you know, we've got, when we hire people, we, in certain professions at least, a pension is the competitive outcome of the hiring process. We'll discuss in a minute what kind of pension, of course, and how big it is. And as you said, when retirement starts, those are all dimensions that are going to be important. But it could just be, well, you know, it turns out we haven't fully planned for the future, so taxes will have to be a little bit higher than they otherwise would have to be in it. So the real question, I think, that it comes down to it is the magnitude. And you've done quite a bit of work to try to figure out what that magnitude is. And I'm curious both what your estimates of that magnitude is, how big the problem is, and also how you go about actually trying to figure out what that magnitude is, because that methodology, it can't be totally straightforward.
Not at all. The methodology is not totally straightforward. And in fact, one of the biggest issues with this is that the costs that state and local governments are ascribing to the pension promises that they are making to state and local workers today are very, very different, much lower than what economists and financial professionals would view as being the true financial costs of a pension promise. And the problem with that is that leads state and local governments to be able to say, hey, we're really running a balanced budget here because we're costing these pension promises out at some number. But in fact, the costs that they're being ascribed by the governments today are a lot lower than the true costs. And what we've seen up until now is that there already is now a large gap between the promises that the governments have made to public sector employees under their own accounting and measurement, relative to the assets that have been set aside, relative to the planning that has been done. And even the own measurements of the governments themselves are vastly under-measuring the order of magnitude of the problem of the promises that have been made relative to the assets that have been set aside and the ability of the state to pay. So in terms of some numbers, what we did was we added up the liabilities myself and my co-author Robert Novy Marks, who is a professor of finance at the Simon School of Business at the University of Rochester. We started out by adding up all of the disclosed unfunded liabilities, so it's total pension promises and unfunded pension promises across all the systems in the U.S. that we could get data on. And we found that there were around $1 to $1.25 trillion in unfunded pension liabilities in these systems. And that's a number that's very similar. It's also what you see is having been reported by the Pew Foundation, which has studied this issue, and others who just, if you go and you just look up your government's report, if you add up for California, CalPERS and CalSTRS, these are the pension systems that pay for public sector employee pensions. If you kind of aggregate up all the systems in the country, you get to about $1 to $1.25 trillion of unfunded pension liabilities, which sounds like a lot, but it really is a lot less than what the true unfunded liability is. And I'll talk about that in a minute, just to make sure that listeners can think in trillions. I mean, I like to think about $1 trillion as around $9,000 per U.S. household. So that's kind of what it works out to. Others like to think about trillions of dollars in terms of how far a stack of $1 trillion would reach if you could get to the moon with a stack of $1 trillion. But I don't think that's as useful. That kind of depends on physics and stacking and folding and things like that. We're useful to think about $1 trillion as being about $9,000 per U.S. household. So to get to the measurement point and sort of the point of our research, we investigated what kinds of assumptions the systems were making in terms of arriving at that number. And what we discovered was that the governmental accounting standards were basically telling the systems to project out the money that they were going to owe, that we were going to owe, the taxpayers are going to owe to public sector retirees, and then to discount that back or turn that into one number today based on an assumption that the assets will earn a certain amount of money. So the assets that we're setting aside will earn a certain amount of money. And the way that had been implemented was that they're basically assuming that every dollar that goes into the pension systems was going to earn roughly 8% compound annualized returns going forward, with certainty. And the idea here behind these governmental accounting standards board standards is you can say, look, our portfolio historically achieved an 8% return. So therefore, we're going to budget going forward, assuming that the money that we put in the fund is also going to earn an 8% return going forward. And, if it achieves the 8% return, then great. If it surpasses the 8% return, then we'll be able to reduce some contributions in the future. And if it falls short of the 8% return, then taxpayers will have to make up the difference.
But Josh, before you go on, clarify where that money currently being invested comes from. So there's good news so far. You've pointed out that the government actually does put some money, state governments do actually put some money aside for pension funds, that money is earning some return. And you're saying that the expected return and the accounting that's done on how healthy the system is assumed that it earns 8%, which is, of course, really high. But putting that aside for the moment, tell us where that money actually comes from. So the fact that they've actually put some money aside is somewhat encouraging. So where does it come from?
Absolutely. It's far better that they're putting some money aside than the scenario I sketched out originally, where you just make promises and don't set any money aside. The money comes from both the public sector employers. So that means, the state and local governments themselves and the employees. And it's difficult to get a really good breakdown of what percentage of the contributions come from each of those, because it's actually very complex. The way it ends up working is that there's a sort of cost that's ascribed to the ongoing accrual of new benefits. That's called the normal cost or the service cost. And then there's also a cost that is related to the making up of unfunded liabilities, which these accounting standards suggest that governments are supposed to try to do, meaning that if you get to a point where you haven't been making the 8% returns, and indeed we haven't been making the 8% returns in the last decade, then you have to start putting additional money into the fund. You also have the problem that even though a contribution could be nominally an employee contribution, it came out in Wisconsin, for example, during the discussion about the union measures, that the state was actually picking up the employees' contributions. So, the true incidence is difficult to say whether it falls mostly on taxpayers or more on employees. Certainly, employees have taken lower salaries in exchange for these pension promises.
Sure.
But contributions are coming from a mix of the resources of general government revenues and also from resources that would be used to pay public employees.
And of course, this also happens in the private sector as well, right? Up in a certain way. So let's talk about that distinction. You and I both work at Stanford. Stanford chips in. I don't have to make all of my retirement contributions on my own. Stanford pays some of it, my employer. That seems like a normal thing. What's wrong with what's going on at the state employee level?
Okay. Well, we have to draw a big distinction here because at Stanford and for most private sector employees, we're in systems that are called defined contribution plans, like 401k types of plans, okay, like the 401k, where the employer contributes some money, the employee contributes some money into an individual account. The account, is managed by the employee. The account, may grow in value, and then the employee, him or herself, is basically responsible for turning that balance into something that's going to pay for their retirement. They're responsible for spending it down or buying an annuity or something like that. The state and local governments are defined benefit pension systems. These are systems where the government is promising, we will pay you a benefit. We will pay you a benefit that is a function of the number of years you've worked for the state and what your salary, your late career salary is at the government, state or local government that you're working for. And that promise is a pledge to pay the benefit no matter what the stock market does. So the issue is that if we're not budgeting enough today for these things, for these pension promises, and we're not setting aside enough money for the pension promises, then the employees are going to reach retirement and they're going to say, look, we don't care how much money you set aside in the fund or how much you told us to set aside. You made us this promise and we took lower salaries for that promise. And as a result, there's going to have to be great tax increases or spending cuts or something, some finding of resources to be able to pay for the difference between the cost of the actual pension promise and the much smaller amount that was set aside.
So your point, which we just took a little road trip to a little diversion to clarify, your point is that the amounts that are set aside, that are being set aside, are only a fraction of the necessary amount, partly because the presumption that the money that is set aside is going to grow at 8%. So if you think that's unrealistic, the question then is, what's a more realistic number?
I think it's worth understanding where this 8% discount rate number came from, and what on what basis state and local governments justify. And I will say that a lot of the difference between what we are measuring as the true unfunded liability of state and local governments and what they are measuring as their unfunded liabilities comes down to this discount rate, this 8% number. So historically, you know, the last 30 or 40 years, pension funds have been investing in a portfolio of stocks and bonds that has returned around 8% per year. That's kind of the historical realized value. And they're therefore using as their budgetary plan an 8% number. They're sort of assuming that, okay, going forward, we're gonna earn this 8% number. And you know, a lot of people would look at that and say, well, I don't know.
That seems fair. Yeah. We're often warned past returns are no guarantee of future success. Yes. It seems like the right place to start.
Right. Past returns are no guarantee of future success. And I think the thing that we're going to see, and I'm going to illustrate this for you with some examples in a second, is that because the public sector pension promise is a guarantee, that is exactly the reason why you cannot use the returns on risky assets to try to measure what the value of that guarantee actually is. So I'm going to give you an example. Okay, so I want you to think through. I'm going to try not to give you too many numbers, but this is an example that I think will kind of help clarify things. Suppose that you have a debt of $100,000 due in 15 years. Okay, I'm going to sort of set up a simplified financial household for you. Okay, so that's your debt. Now, suppose you also have some cash in a bank account, okay? And that cash is approximately $31,000. So you have a debt of $100,000 that's due in 15 years. You have $31,500 in cash, and you go to a bank and you want to apply for another loan. Okay? So this is your household's financial situation. Now, the bank is going to assess your financial position. And if you have a steady, high-paying job, the bank might say, fine, you're approved for the loan. If you don't have a job, if you're unemployed, haven't had a job in a long time, the bank would probably look at you and say, you're probably not a great candidate for this loan. So imagine that you were in the position of someone who had applied for this additional loan and had not received the loan. Now, what if you did the following? Okay, suppose you went home, you thought about it, you were feeling a little dejected that you had been rejected for this loan. So you decided that you were going to move the $31,500 from cash into a portfolio of stocks and bonds. And that is a portfolio of stocks and bonds that historically you've observed has earned an 8% return. And in fact, you have an idea, which is that you're going to go back to the bank the following day. And you're going to say, all right, I'm the guy, remember me from yesterday, I applied for this loan here. And now something has changed. Okay, so yesterday I had the $31,500 in cash. Now I've got it in stocks and bonds. And if you take $31,500 and you multiply it by, gross it up by 8% per year compounded for 15 years, you will see that my $31,500 that I have in this account today is going to be sufficient to cover the $100,000 debt that I have in 15 years. So I'm just going to
debt free. I'm really I'm a great risk because I don't have any net debt.
Debt free because this $31,500 is perfectly going to offset the $100,000 that's due in 15 years. And of course, the bank would not accept that logic. And no one in the private sector would accept that logic. And if you really tried to do something like that and you signed your name to it, you would probably be taken to jail. So I would definitely not advocate that any listeners attempt, to make such a statement. But the governmental accounting for pensions says, yes, you can do that. You can assume when you budget that the money that every dollar that you've got on hand is going to earn 8% returns with certainty. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what's really wrong with that. I mean, there's so much wrong with that example that it's hard to know where to begin. I mean, I think the first thing is that a lot of people are recalibrating their investment expectations.
Yes, they are.
The 8% returns that were achieved historically, these were achieved historically at a time when you could get pretty decent returns on risk, you know, essentially risk-free assets. You could get, you know, the in treasury inflation-protected securities, you know, were giving you, you know, as of the late 90s, they were giving you 3% returns above inflation. So, you know, if inflation were running at 3%, you could get a 6% return in just about the safest security around. So, you know, achieving an 8% return with a little bit of risk in some other part of the portfolio, you know, didn't seem that unlikely. Today, you've got, you know, risk-free assets earn basically zero real. So, inflation plus zero or even negative. If you want to even get a return of guaranteed return of inflation, if you bought a treasury inflation protected security, these are bonds that the U.S. Treasury issues that are tied to inflation. Your return is going to be, it will keep up with spending power if you buy a 20-year or 25-year government security, but not a shorter maturity security. So the kinds of returns that seem to be available in the market today are a lot lower. So one of the problems with my example that I gave you, one of the things that I'm sure listeners would say is, well, look, you know, we may have earned 8% historically, but there's kind of a new normal going on in financial markets that suggests that it's just going to be a lot harder to earn those same returns going forward. So that's one problem. Another problem is that what I just said, I mean, it doesn't quite get to the point of why the bank actually won't give you any credit at all for moving your assets from cash into stocks. You know, they wouldn't just say, well, you know, we won't allow you to calculate 8%, but maybe we'll allow you to assume, you know, a 4 or 5% return on this stuff. And I think that's interesting because, you know, if you asked me if I think stocks will outperform government bonds over the long run, I would say it's, you know, maybe more likely than not. But the point is that there is substantial risk there. And, you know, as the warning goes, as we were saying, past returns are no guarantee of future performance. We've told the public employees that we will pay for these pensions no matter what the stock market does. And proper financial accounting reflects that as a guarantee. It does not allow us to make a contract with our kids that says, look, you guys will pay for the pensions if the stock market does badly. We will have budgeted sufficiently if the stock market does well. You know, the returns on stocks that we got historically were not a free lunch. Stocks are risky. Very, very bad outcomes are possible. And furthermore, very bad outcomes are going to come exactly at those times when the future generations, us in the future or our kids, are not going to be in a very good position to come up with more money in the way of tax revenues or be able to handle government spending cuts in order to pay for the retirements of public sector employees. So it's really a problem. We've set this up so that, you know, exactly at those times when the private sector would be most unable to pay for their own retirement, they're going to have to come up with money for the retirements of public sector employees that you know, should have been properly, you know, where those systems should have been properly set up in the past. These taxpayers in the future are going to have to make up the difference at the worst possible times.
Yeah, another way to say it is that the risk falls on the taxpayer rather than on the employees, which is nice for them. Normally, that's okay.
Yeah.
If you pay for that in the form of lower wages, there's a lot of things we do in life where we trade security. We're happy to accept security in return for a lower return, but they're getting a generous promise where the riskiness of that promise is paid for by someone else. And that's a recipe for – that's a bad set of incentives.
Yeah, I mean, think about it this way. I mean basically, you know, we have written a large insurance policy on the stock market, and we have got to come up with a lot of money, additional money for public sector employees if the stock market does not perform. There are ways to provide guaranteed pensions to people. They're called deferred annuities.
Yeah.
And if you look at what other countries do, okay, when other countries, you know, let's look at – so the Netherlands is my favorite because they have a very long tradition of providing occupational defined benefit pensions, these kinds of pensions that we have here in the public sector, for just about everybody in the Netherlands with a job. They're eligible for one of these occupational defined benefit pensions. And what do they do? Well, they measure the promises using risk-free interbank swap rates, which are essentially 0% for near-term liabilities. So that they're using a 0% discount rate. And for the longest-term payments, for a payment that's 30, 40, 50 years out, they allow rates of no more than around 4%. And you know, you look at many other. I mean, I can compare this to what goes on. I think it would be instructive to compare it to what goes on actually in the U.S. corporate sector when companies sponsor pension systems. But you know, it's clear when I go and speak to international audiences about the way that we measure pensions in the U.S. You know, I think they think that our governments are behaving very irresponsibly.
But the worst part of this, now that that's all very interesting and great to know. The worst part is that you said even by the state's own assumptions of 8%, it's a $1 to $1.25 trillion unfunded liability, right? So the actual liability, if you used a more reasonable projection of expected return, it is dramatically larger. Unfortunately,
right. The actual unfunded liability is $4.4 trillion as of the end of 2011.
And so, that would be about $36,000 per American household. Is that correct?
Yeah. $38,000 per U.S. household. And you know, so that's a huge burden. Now, you know, some interesting notes about that I would add. You know, if you live in a major metropolitan area, so some examples that come to mind are Chicago or Los Angeles. Your unfunded liability is actually a lot bigger than that because you know, cities have larger public sectors. They're providing more in the way of services, and this hidden debt, this debt in disguise, or off balance sheet debt that we owe to public sector employees, you know, is higher for places where there's a larger public sector. And so, you know, in Chicago, you're looking at about $80,000 per household of unfunded debt. So basically of credit card debt that the city and state have run up on your behalf.
It's a bargain, but that's a bargain for the high quality schools that they have, Josh.
Sorry about that.
Let's put that to the side. But it's $80,000 per household in Chicago for the current value of expected future promises.
Yeah, net of after the using the assets that have already been set aside. So the unfunded promises. And you know, I think I just want to. I mean, just to come back to what I've worked on is not really said very much at all about the overall generosity of pensions or whether public sector employees are paid too much or too little. The real issue is that we have been pretending that we are compensating them less than we actually are, and that's we've been doing this stuff with deferred compensation. We're paying in promises, and when you have paying in promises and those promises aren't measured properly. You really have a kicking the can down the road kind of dynamic where no politician wants to touch this. I mean, anytime somebody brings up the idea of, well, maybe we should lower the discount rate because it's unrealistic, the response is, well, wait a second. We can't afford to lower the discount because that would mean that we'd have to put more money into the pension fund today. And what that doesn't recognize is that the cost of making a deferred guaranteed promise it's invariant to what you decide you want to set aside today to fund that. That cost is something that financial markets tell us very clearly what it costs. You know, you can look at markets for deferred annuities. If the state went to an insurance company and said, you know, we'd like you guys to pay these pension benefits, can you give us a price? The insurance company would surely not say, yeah, well, we'll give you a price, and since we've seen you've earned 8% historically on your investments, we'll give you a price based on 8% return. No, the insurance company is going to say, well, you want us to pay this in all states of the world? You want us to provide deferred annuities for your employees? Deferred annuities have a price in today's market, and you know, those are going to be based on discount rates that are pretty close to zero these days.
So there's this literature on whether private or public sector employees of the same skill level are paid competitive salaries, right? I don't know if you've looked at that, but it makes me wonder whether they include pensions in assessing the comparability of private and public sector pay.
Yeah, I think there has been some work that has been done I've seen various papers that have attempted to remeasure the public sector, cost of the public sector pension promises using the lower, you know, the financially based discount rates, and it is very hard to get true comparables. I mean, in economics, this is very, very difficult to be able to say these two people are truly you know, truly comparable. You know, another point about this unfunded debt, you know, the $80,000 per household for the Chicagoans and the total of $4.4 trillion of unfunded liabilities around the U.S. You know, compared to federal debt of $16 trillion and potentially much more in Medicare and Social Security,
it's nothing.
At first glance, right, it may seem small. I mean, this is just another, you know, quarter of federal debt.
It's a wart.
Wart. But let me tell you why I think it's not a wart, okay? And that's for the following. You know, the federal government controls the money supply. They can print money. State and local governments cannot. And that's why I think actually a comparison to Europe, again, is quite useful. You know, let's look at Greece. Greece is not a systemically important country. It's a small state, 2% of GDP, within a broader Europe. But its financial overextension led to the realization, two realizations, really. First of all, that there were others that actually weren't in such great shape either. And secondly, that the legal frameworks did not exist for restructuring this debt. That there's no way to work this out. We have no real legal way to work this out because we'd been assuming all along that the money was just gonna be there. And you know, like California and Illinois, Greece does not have its own currency. So I think, you know, when you look at it in that light, you know, the magnitudes of you know, the unfunded liabilities, say, you know, the German government may be a lot bigger than you know those of Greece. You know, the problem is that the even, you know, smaller states, when they don't control their money supply, they have no control of their money supply, and they you know make these overextended promises, can really lead to crises of confidence when financial market participants just don't see an exit for this. They see no way of the, you know, no legal pathway for restructuring the debt. And that kind of uncertainty can really do a number in financial markets.
But I think it's worse than that, actually. It seems to me it's the real risk is the breakdown of civilization, which we saw a little bit of in Greece, not so bad, because eventually a mechanism was discovered, partly because they are a small country relative to the rest of the countries involved. I mean, if you think about California, coming to a point in the semi-near future where it cannot honor the promises it's made to its public employees without either very large increases in taxes on current taxpayers, pleading in Washington that all other Americans chip in, or telling those retirees that the promises we made aren't going to be kept. Now, normally in politics, you'd think all three things would happen. You kind of get a mix. You get a compromise. But that's because there's often governance measures that let that compromise take place. And I think what you're really pointing out is that those measures don't exist. We don't have what we've done in the past. You mentioned 1837. The government said, we can't. As a federal politician, a national politician, I can't make other taxpayers outside of California pay for California's irresponsibility. So then you go inside California. This isn't a small group of 100 or 1,000 people. These are thousands of people who are expecting large sums of money, and they're going to fall very unpleasantly on another group of people. I don't know how that's going to turn out.
Hundreds of thousands of people. Also, in these hundreds of thousands of people, happen to provide services that we rely on every day for our public safety and for the education of our kids. Could there be a worse arrangement than to borrow, you know, the huge amounts of money that we can't pay back to people whom we depend upon crucially every day for government services? You know, that just, you know, just creates a very, very, because you can imagine what, you know, what's going to happen if we tell public sector employees we can't make these guaranteed promises.
They strikes. Say, well,
yeah, strikes, exactly. You know, and so I think, you know, the breakdown of civilization over these kinds of things, over, you know, breakdown of a functioning government that can provide these services that we rely on, is you know, unfortunately going to become increasingly likely.
Yeah, but I think the strike is the least that'd be a great outcome. Then you negotiate some settlement, but that's a settlement you'd usually negotiate with current employees over future benefits. We're talking about trying to renegotiate past promises to current retirees.
Right.
It's going to get nasty. Before we go a little further, and we're going to talk about, and it's pretty depressing so far on this very rainy day on the East Coast, and high winds are promised, and it's not a good day to be outside. before we get, we're actually going to talk about, I hope, what might we do to make this better down the road, or at least deal with it. Before we do that, you said we haven't said anything about whether these pensions are too big or too small. The only thing you've talked about so far is that they've not been planned for. But there is this other political unpleasant problem, which is the size of the pensions and the way they're calculated have been negotiated in the past in a way that a lot of people would say is really not so attractive or fair. So can you talk about that, or do you want to talk about it?
Well, I can talk about it a little bit. I mean,
what I'm asking is that I've read these cases. I don't know how representative they are, where a chief of a fire department or police will retire at a young age, having taken lots of overtime in the year or two before they retire because the pension's based on the last year, which seems like a nice thing, except they pile in lots of stuff and they end up making a pension well over $100,000, sometimes $150,000, that dwarfs anything available to somebody in the private sector because the way the rules have been made. Is that a weird outlier that just makes the news, or is that all too common? Do we know anything about that?
Okay, well, you know, I think we know that it is not – okay, so what is uncommon are, I think, you know, the situation in Bell, California, where you had public sector employees making, you know, $700,000 or $800,000 per year without people really understanding and setting their pensions accordingly. I think that is not that common. Yes. What is quite common? I mean, here in California, there was a scandal over Contra Costa County, where a fire chief was earning a $186,000 salary before he retired, and he was somehow able to turn this into a $241,000 pension per year that was going to grow at three. You know, these pensions grow, by the way. I mean, they're cost of living adjustments. So $241,000 was his starting pension per year. And you know, which he took when he was 50 or 52, and
only 30 or 40 years, more years of it.
Yeah, right. And he was able to get this by having the city repurchase unused sick pay credits,
right,
that he had left there, and that reset his pensionable salary to this $241,000 number.
And then if I remember correctly, he then went back and worked part time.
Yes.
At a very large salary while he was collecting the pension.
Right. So that's another issue, is that public sector employees can often go back and work part-time. You know, if people can go back and work part-time, it's not clear what the justification is for providing them with a benefit that looks like this. The actual spiking piece of this, you know, so spiking is whatever he did to get his $186,000 salary up to a $241,000 pension. You know, spiking, I think, is something that's a sort of abuse that a lot of states have tried to take aim at in legislative action. What's somewhat either depressing or amusing is that even spiking, it's been very difficult for them to say that current employees, will be unable to spike their pensions, because there's a lot of both political muscle and also some legal analysis behind the argument that, look, these guys are protected. You can't tell them not to spike their pensions. So even sometimes you'll read about a reform, a much, you know, widely touted reform that says it targets abuses and spiking, and says, well, you know, new hires will not be able to engage in pension spiking. I mean, we're talking about, you know, whether somebody 30 years down the line is going to be able to turn their $186,000 salary into a $241,000 pension. That's not going to be much help for the 30 years between now and then when people can. But you know, I've seen evidence that's papers that suggest that spiking might cost California some number in the hundreds of millions of dollars per year, which is not insignificant relative to relative to billions, tens of billions of retirement costs. But is not really the root of the problem. I mean, if we had been, if all of these things had been transparent from the outset, and it had been possible for taxpayers or for taxpayer watchdog groups or legislators who had an incentive to care about fiscal soundness to actually monitor what was going on, we would have said, we would have said in real time, whoa, wait a second, these things are really expensive. We need to make sure that we're offering people something that we can pay for and that we're budgeting properly. But all of this is hidden behind the shroud of you know, mostly again of these return assumptions and these discount rates. You know, the only justification for using a discount rate that is higher than a default free rate, like what's used in the Netherlands, is if you want to credit the government for its option to default on these benefits.
Yeah.
And companies have recognized this for quite a while. You know, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the FASB accounting, has companies using high-grade corporate yield curves to measure their pension liabilities, which makes a lot of sense for companies because those pension promises are really like corporate bonds. You know, as companies approach, you know, if they end up in bankruptcy, like, you know, United Airlines, for example, they become absolved of their pension obligations, and those obligations are taken over by the U.S. government, where they are haircutted and then remeasured using treasury curves. So I got away a little bit from the spiking question, but I guess it just highlights the fact that I think that, you know, while spiking adds to the costs, I mean, the true problem is just that all of this is these are hidden ways for state and local governments to circumvent their balanced budget requirements and to be able to spend more money today than they're taking in tax revenue and to be able to call that a balanced budget because of the assumptions that they're making in their planning.
I wonder how aware public employees are of this problem. I mean, a lot of young people that I talk to expect to get nothing from Social Security in their current contributions, so-called contributions.
Which would be a bad expectation, right? I mean, that would be on Social Security, that would be an incorrect expectation.
I think so, but who knows? Yeah. But they expect zero, which is a little bit overly pessimistic.
Yes, they're not going to get zero, but they're probably not going to get what the statement says they're going to get.
Probably. And that, I assume, is also maybe kind of true of at the state level. I don't know. As you say, there's no – what's going to happen with Social Security is that I think, you know, the retirement age is going to be bumped up. The tax rate's going to – the so-called contribution level of payroll tax is going to be increased. Maybe the benefits are going to be indexed differently. That's different though because those are all federal legislation that's – you know, Congress can change Social Security anytime it wants. But the things we're talking about, these are contractual obligations between a state government and the union that I think are of a different legal nature, or am I wrong?
That's really the problem. No, that's exactly right, Russ. That's really the problem. Well, look, we have a history in this country of adjusting Social Security, making technical adjustments to Social Security benefits and contributions in order to put the system back into balance. And we had that in the late 70s and early 80s. And you know, Social Security is a pay-as-you-go system, but it's one where there's an understanding that now we need the political will to be able to do this. And again, you know, with the extent to which you know, Congress is polarized in, you know, the sort of political gridlock that we have in Washington, you know, maybe a tall order, but there is a history of revising Social Security benefits. The problem that we've seen in the states is governor after governor in the U.S. and the U.S. states have tried to put forth pension change, you know, proposals to change pensions, and they've been met pretty much with the resistance of the groups that, you know, the public sector unions and the people who have been promised these pensions, who have said, look, this is a contractual promise. You can't change these. And then what's happened is that the governments, the legislatures, the governors have typically backed down and said, okay, well, we'll water this pension reform down so that it only affects newer employees.
Right.
And new brand new employees, not just newer, but brand new employees. So these are promises that are viewed as having been part of the contract. And so just like, you know, Greece has no way of restructuring its sovereign debt, we have no way of restructuring these promises. We have I think the result is going to be that we're going to reach a point where there is even more serious competition for scarce government resources to, you know, pay for schools and roads and teachers and public safety officials versus to pay the pensions of the people who worked in the past. It's just not easy to make technical adjustments to change benefits that are already being received by people or that are going to be received even by the current working group of public sector employees.
But it does. I mean, maybe I don't have enough knowledge of the legal system, legal issues involved, and maybe you don't either, but it would seem to me that if I'm negotiating with the firefighters and I've made of today about current salaries, current overtime, current pensions, and I've made past promises to firefighters that are turned out to be quite much more expensive than I thought, or I didn't put enough aside for whatever reason as a state. It seems to me it's imaginable that past contract could be renegotiated on the basis of current terms could play a role in that. Is that imaginable? Could that be?
Well, it's imaginable. I think the retirees, they have very strong political power themselves. The question is, would there ever be a situation where the kind of younger public sector workers would be able to negotiate things, yeah, and kind of in a sense sell out, yep, the older retirees. I think the dynamic that makes that really difficult is that who really controls the bargaining that goes on? Who are the people who are really at the table in public sector unions when doing the bargaining? They are individuals who themselves are only a couple of years away from retirement.
Right.
And so they have to find – they would have to kind of very fine. They don't want to lower their own packages.
True.
But, you know, so it would be very hard for them to be able to find a way to sort of draw the dark line right where the line between the workers and the retirees, you know, the people, yeah, who are, you know, age 60 or something. So I think that dynamic, while it's conceivable that we could get there, is very difficult. You know, I'll certainly say that, I mean, if I were a younger public sector employee, I would think of these the contributions that I was making to these pension systems as pretty much not going to get me anything. I mean, I think that there, you know, compared to Social Security, it'd be a bad assumption to think that your Social Security contributions are going to get you nothing. It would probably not be that bad an assumption to plan, if you are a younger teacher or public safety official, to plan that the money that you're putting in, it's being deducted from your payroll to go to these defined benefit systems, is probably not going to get you very much. Which actually leads me to I think what's a pretty frightening point, which is that there are 5 or 6 million public sector employees, retirees who are outside of Social Security. They are not in the Social Security system at all. They were not, their systems never opted in when the Social Security Act was passed. And as a result, they are reliant only on this pension as a source of retirement income. So, well, you know, on the one hand, they're going to, you know, the stories are going to come out. They're going to be people who retire very early. In fact, I was in Rhode Island, and they were talking about some of their municipal systems where people were retiring in their 40s on sort of recharacterizing pensions as disability. You're going to have people abusing the system. You're going to hear about these costly things. But on the other hand, there are going to be many rank and file individuals who are not trying to game the system, who are trying to have a secure retirement, who may not have great employment prospects after they leave the public sector at age 55, and they are completely dependent on the state pension for their retirement. They have no Social Security, so I think that is something that should make younger public sector employees, particularly the public safety officials who are not, you know, many of whom are not in Social Security, worried and should want to address this problem.
Yeah, no, it's a nasty thing. Well, let's talk about what might be done. What could we do that would be better if we were thinking about this from scratch? And then what possible things might be done in the middle, now that we're in the middle of it? So
right.
One obvious way to fix this going forward is to have a more realistic assumption about the growth rate or the discount rate. What we've been talking about, the 8% really should be 2 or 3 or 1.5. So that's one way to make it clear. And the goal here isn't to get rid of public pensions. The goal here is to figure out a way to make it transparent so that the political process can make the decision rationally in some dimension, whatever that means.
Exactly.
But at least there's some understanding of what's going on. And
that's exactly right. Yes.
So one way to do that is the lower the discount rate to a more realistic number. The other would be to move away from defined benefit and toward defined contribution. Correct.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, and I put it even a little bit more strongly, which is that, you know, as long as state and local governments are going to reject the imperative of proper cost measurement, they shouldn't be offering new defined benefit promises, and they should be moving to defined contribution. If they want to accept are willing to accept the financial reality that a guaranteed deferred promise is, you know, you got to cost that out at very, very low discount rates. Has been recognized, you know, around the world and by corporate accounting and by everybody else. Then, you know, the DB systems, you know, could continue. Unfortunately, I see nobody who wants to go near this discount rate. Anyone who wants to proclaim they're doing pension reform, they just want to do something that sort of, you know, kind of nibbles around the edges. Now, there have been some of that nibbling has gone into some farther reaching, far more biting measures, I suppose, which I think, you know, as I mentioned before, a lot of the pensions have cost of living adjustments associated with them, often called COLAs. And some of the most far-reaching reforms have been those that have actually tried to modify those COLAs, those cost of living adjustments, under the argument that, well, these aren't really part of the true contractual promise. The base benefit might have been, but this COLA is sort of a technical thing that we can potentially try to change. And New Jersey suspended the cost of living adjustments. They'll be reinstated when, you know, if and when funding gets back to some certain level, at least under the government's own measures. Rhode Island did something similar, suspending cost of living adjustments while also moving people a little bit more to some mixed defined benefit, defined contribution plans that I'll talk about it in a second. So those cost of living adjustments are actually really expensive, and reductions in cost of living adjustments, which have received traction in a lot of states, do actually kind of, you know, set you kind of reset the liability to a level that could be, depending on the parameter, you could deal with with 30 or 40% of the unfunded liability problem by, you know, eliminating the COLAs. Eliminating the COLAs, of course, also, in some places, the COLA is not just a 3% giveaway, but also is a link to inflation of a not very generous initial base benefit. So some retirees would feel that very strongly.
Yeah.
But I think that the point is that, you know, at least when you see these reductions in COLAs, they do reduce the kind of benefit, the unfunded liability, in the near term, but they don't put the future on much of a better footing, because as long as you're still running these defined benefit systems, you are still running these imbalanced budgets, and you're going to that savings that you just earned, you just created from reducing the cost of living adjustment, they're just going to slowly be eaten away by the fact that we're still continuing to mismeasure every new day of pension promises that we make.
Yeah, it just says that instead of being four, it's not, instead of being, say, 8.8, it's really only 4.4 trillion. So
right. I mean, you know, so and then that 4.4 will continue to grow. You know, if the only thing we change is the cost of living adjustment, you know, those numbers that I gave you before, by the way, I mean, those are only the legacy liabilities. That's the present value of what we've promised today. Even if we thought it was advisable and could and did freeze all of the pension promises at today's levels and compensated people using defined contribution plans going forward, even then, that 4.4 trillion would still be there. So the point is that unless we reform the system, we're in a situation where that 4.4 trillion is growing, and adjusting the cost of living adjustment, that gets you sort of a near term reduction in that kind of number, but it also, it doesn't change the fact that number is just going to continue to grow. So it kind of buys time. So in terms of, all right, well, let's say we want to move out of the defined benefit realm. What about defined contribution options? So what about the option of, let's just give everybody 401ks? Well, I think it's worth pointing out that part of the difficulty here is that 401ks have suffered in the private sector from poor investment choices and high fees, and have not exactly been a resounding success for guaranteeing the retirement security of private sector Americans. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff happening in the 401k world. what's important to recognize, and what's recognized in other countries and in some very small pockets of our economy, is that 401k plans are not the only kind of defined contribution pension plan that you can have. So there, first of all, there are very simple improvements to 401ks that could make them a lot better. So the federal government employees, they're actually ones that have been hired in the last 20 years or so. They are on a defined contribution plan that's kind of like a 401k plan. It's called the Federal Thrift Savings Plan. Because the federal government is big, they're able to negotiate very good, you know, very low fees with the providers of these plans, and they're also savvy in setting up a plan that gives people, you know, reasonable investment choices, not large numbers of unnecessary high expense mutual fund choices and things like that, but is a plan that, you know, provides people with very good choices for them to elect, and also gives them the option to make an annuity out of their wealth at retirement. One thing one could imagine is just have a thrift savings program, you know, for state employees, which would really just be an individual account system for state employees, where states would you know, use their bargaining power to negotiate low fees with mutual fund advisors. That's one option. Another option is to say, okay, well, you know, maybe we actually don't necessarily want to go all the way to the individual account. Maybe we're concerned about the choices that behavioral economics suggests that people are making in 401ks. And what you could do then, if you believe that that's the right way to look after public sector employees, is you could set up what's called a pooled defined contribution plan. And what that is, I guess the best way to describe that is, take one of these big systems like CalPERS, the California Public Employee Retirement System. Instead of there being a baseline guarantee for that, you know, you will earn a pension that is going to be a function of how many years you worked, what your salary is, etc. You instead basically just give employees shares, ownership stakes in CalPERS. This is a pooled collective defined contribution vehicle. And then what happens is, when the employee retires, they will get a pension that is based on the value of their claim in the pension fund. And this is not unlike what has been offered by TIAA CREF for many years to some college professors. I've never been part of TIAA CREF myself, but these pooled defined contribution vehicles allow individuals to have an ownership stake in the pension fund. Then they're not making their own investment decisions if they don't want to, and they can then get a pension when they retire. That's a function of how these assets have performed, but without taxpayer guarantees. So there is a way to still have pooled investment without taxpayer guarantees. And I think that's a reasonable option to consider as well. I think we have to put all these options on the table. And if they won't accept the imperative of proper defined benefit cost accounting, then some kind of defined contribution arrangement seems necessary.
Well, necessary to you and me. The question is, if you went to a public employee right now and said, which do you prefer, this guarantee with this current structure or this other thing, this pooled defined contribution, they'd say, I think I'm in for the – I like what I have.
So yeah,
I think
the problem is that – and that shows you – that reflects to you that the guaranteed benefit is a more valuable benefit than a non-guaranteed benefit. And that's why we can't keep using these return assumptions, because the return assumptions ignore the guarantee. That fact that the public employee would say, no, I prefer the return guarantee. Well, I mean, that indicates that the pension is a – you know, the guaranteed deferred promise – is indeed a costly thing. And if you try, just imagine, you know, trying to set that up for yourself. Imagine if you wanted to buy bonds or annuities to pay yourself $80,000-$90,000 a year pension when you retire. You would see that would be a very expensive thing for you to set up.
Yeah. So what's where does that leave us? We're out of time. So tell me where you think this might head over the next few years. There have been a few governors that have, as you say, tried to challenge the system. They've become – they've gained some national notoriety, Scott Walker and Chris Christie. I don't know what they've really done. They've certainly talked about, standing up to the public sector unions. I don't know what they really have actually done or said. There's a lot of symbolism here, and I know there's a lot of – on both sides, right? There's a lot of people who are angry at them, maybe for reasons that they haven't done as much as it seems. And maybe there's people who've given them too much credit. But for so-called standing up, whatever that means, at least trying to do something about this issue. And it's, you're in California. What's going to happen there?
No, I'm not optimistic. I mean, I think that it seems that in most situations, the best that can be done is to implement reforms that affect new employees. There have actually been progress. There has been progress in California made through the referendum system. You know, in California, a lot of measures are end up being voted on by by the public, and both San Diego and San Jose put in some measures at the municipal level. But you know, in California, I see more. You know, we've had an increasing number of municipal bankruptcies, Fortin, Stockton, et cetera. And in those bankruptcies, in many cases, you see you basically see a big dispute: who's first in line, the pensioners or the bondholders. In the meantime, you know, the public sector services are getting slashed in these places. And I think, you know, the ability of states to deal with this is going to vary state by state. I mean, Rhode Island did something recently where they pretty much just put bondholders first in line. And many states would not be able to do that because of their laws, their state constitutional provisions. Some might be able to. So I think this is going to be a large, there's going to be a lot of legal contention over what can and can't be done. And I do see a future of a lot more in the way of municipal bankruptcies, disputes about who is first in line, pensioners or bondholders. Meanwhile, you know, taxpayers and recipients of public services are going to get squeezed. You know, we recently had a paper in a post in the op-ed in the Washington Post explaining how, you know, if you wanted to put pensions on a fully funded basis in 30 years, which is a goal that many governments say that they're targeting, you would actually have to increase annual property taxes per household, but you have to be on every household, not even ones that own property, by $1,375 per year and growing with inflation. So those are the kind of resources we need in the U.S. Every year we have to take that amount of money to set to this. And every year we don't do that, that number just gets greater and greater. So I see a future where taxpayers and recipients of public services are going to get squeezed, while bondholders and public sector retirees argue over, who is entitled to the scraps that remain. So I'm not very optimistic. I'd like to believe that we could really make progress through improving defined benefit transparency, through considering the introduction of risk sharing for public sector employees, for borrowing good plans from other countries. But I don't really see the political environment these days is creating very much other than a really unstable system that's going to lead to a fair number of crises in the not too distant future.
My guest today has been Joshua Rao. Josh, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thanks, Russ. My pleasure.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.